The two main areas that I was curious about was one, with the shift to a virtual or semi-virtual online conference format, how to ensure that pre-existing problems with the old system don't simply get ported online, because I think there's a tendency for that to happen if we don't avoid it. And this would be the perfect time to make sure that doesn't happen because of all the experiments that have been carried out, some intentionally, some unintentionally. So I'd just be curious to know what you think about how to ensure that doesn't happen. And the example I pulled out for the pre-light was this issue of internet access and access to virtual resources. So that's one question. And then the second question is about how to preserve the things about in-person meetings that are good in some sort of sustainable format, while also ensuring that those are not preserved only for the people that already had access to them. So local meetings in the UK are good. And that's because the UK scientific community is pretty large and diverse and able to meet without having to fly. But what to do with other sort of arrangements. So those were the two sets of questions I had. So I'd just be happy for any of you to respond with your thoughts, or if you think I'm wrong in framing it that way, or anything.
Well, I think maybe we could hear from Sarvi better, but I think that there will be a big challenge to not transpose the same problems from the in-person meeting to the virtual meetings. But I think that is part of what this new chance gives, right? So if we are starting again, new kind of things. And that brings me to a comment in your text, because you said that the punchline is scientific conference, as we know, is finished. And then I thought we could be saying the same, but in a different way. We like more like the world has changed, so the scientific conference has to, something more like we need to change, because now it's like finished, it's over, but I would like to more like go into the future. And then it's true that we can copy paste everything and do it virtually, and that is going to be a big mess. Or we just change with the world and we do something better and implement this virtual conference. So maybe I would just comment a few things, because I would like to hear all of you guys, and maybe I will have to go after. But one thing that me and Humberto might notice, because we are both from South America, and that's the hub of the eLife Ambassador that we belong to, despite I'm in Europe, is that this virtual conference have flattened the field. So in general, for people to come from South America, you cannot imagine how costly it is. I mean, most of the times it's like coming from India or places like these, developing countries. You gotta, the PIs need to decide for who will go to the meeting or not, and people will present other people, other colleagues' work, because you cannot afford five people to attend the ASCD meeting, for example. So you can make it for one, if any, and then that guy will have concentrated all the science work, which is completely the last of it. Now, with the current situation, there is just a post of a meeting online, they just register and all can have access at the same time to first world science in life. So then really the current situation has flattened the line, the field. So then now there is no difference from colleagues from Sarvi at Johns Hopkins and people from Cordoba where Humberto is, or in Chile where I come from. There is no difference. You just plug in, you connect, you put your headphones and you listen to your meeting. And then you get the same information at the same time. So there is no lack of information, and that is something that really I think is remarkable of the current situation and what can be promoted with the virtual meetings. It's true that we will miss some of the things that you will discuss. In-person meetings have this serendipity that you by chance having a beer, you will meet someone. And I think that's why we put it this way, and Sarvanas was clever and put it in a way that we don't mean that the in-person meetings will completely disappear. Just they have to be reduced to a sustainable form. But to me, and I think Humberto can comment on that as well, this really has make equal opportunities to everybody to assist to the many webinars that are currently online. And that's why with Ron Bale, the co-founder of iBiology, we have discussed this many times, and that was his main aim. So I put first world science in a website that whatever you can connect, you can access to it. Then we come back to your question, how do we ensure access to internet? That is now the key, right? But then I think that is well beyond the scientific community. But we can give a huge punch. We can say, dude, we are offering to spread the knowledge as soon as we have it, to do so, we need people to have access to it. And if they don't have access to it, then we are offering something and no one is profiting from it. Or only the people, privileged people is still getting the profit, and the people that need more to get help, they cannot profit.
If I can just say something. So I think there, of course, well, there are so many different problems with conferences that exist at the moment. I think you can kind of think of them as in a few different categories. So you have problems that are essentially solved or made better when you shift to virtual conferences. So these would be things relating to the environment and also accessibility issues. Then you would have problems that kind of remain, I guess. So this is, for example, internet access. And you would also have problems that maybe would be exacerbated or something that we must be aware of. So, for example, I mean, I was just thinking about childcare. I think that it's not really a problem. Well, maybe some aspects of it get solved when you shift to virtual conferences, but yet you see now that many kind of academics are starting to complain that they cannot be productive at home because of childcare. So it's another issue that cannot be assumed to be solved just because we shift to virtual conferences. So I think that's something that conferences still have to be kind of aware of and to realize still that there are problems that will remain even when we shift online.
I think there are two different things that conferences have. Like the one thing is really you distribute knowledge. And I think given that you have an internet, which is a problem in itself, and we had discussions actually this week exactly about this with African scientists, and there's the problems that you have, you actually can watch this high definition videos because it's just too much of bandwidth and it costs you too much. So, I mean, one solution is simply to make it like less lower qualities, like a different quality streams, so to make it more accessible also, like it in a tiered program in the sense, or download it locally and share it around like this. Of course, at the end, you would have to have internet access, which is a problem, and maybe the scientific community can think about it. And so I think like this knowledge distribution, I think, is something which is way more accessible with virtual events, especially if they're recorded after the fact, I think, which would be really new to like something which hasn't been done much. And I think there comes the other component, which has conferences, which really is the networking. And the second part of the networking, I think it really requires some more thinking and like in more like creativeness and maybe also like more exploring over time, because it hasn't been done really. There's probably a lot of communication which works really different online in a big group, and Zoom, everybody probably had this like, oh, no, you talk now, and like, who's going to talk now? But in a room, you can read a room, but it's really hard to do this like next thing. But then at the same time, maybe like if you're five times down Jones Road, like kids do this nowadays. Like kids nowadays, they play video games and they have the headphones on, and like they group play with 15, 20 people. So that's how like people work. So maybe we are not used to it, but maybe like actually a younger generation which has lived more online, which has more like these online skills new acquired, maybe actually talking with them and see what actually happened there might be actually really good things you can learn from.
Just want to comment on one. Benjamin said at the beginning the TED Talks were distributed like this, like they were recorded and then afterward distributed, and they were already quite effective. But of course, it was much better when they went online, right? But this had done before with the TED Talks. I know they were distributed probably in VHS or something like this. And then something we can propose or we can think of is that part of the funding, the part of the money that will not be used in the many things that meetings are spent, the catering and so on, could be used to make a distribution of the tool. Specifically places, as Benjamin said, that they do not have access. We will not distribute this in New York or whatever, in Paris, we don't need it. But then we will send this to specifically libraries or universities in different points that then can generate local hubs. And then maybe afterwards, they do the local hub to retransmit the signals, for example. So
yeah.
To say.
Yeah, if I can also comment on this.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so our suggestions to shifting to virtual conferences. One, at situations like what we're going through now, the COVID-19, it's unavoidable. The situation may stay for a long time, and scientists will still need to network to share their findings. So what we offer is an alternative, one of the alternatives probably, on how, as a scientific community, we can continue to communicate and exchange information. So it's very applicable. Second, as someone already noted, some of the issues may remain. Some of the inherent issues with a physical scientific conferences may be carried into virtual conferences. But still, I would say virtual conferences are much better in the sense that, take for example, the case of cost. If, say, in developing countries, scientists cannot afford internet, then they may never be able to afford to attend a physical conference because it's expensive, and usually they're carried in European countries, even when they are carried in regional contexts, some other country in Africa. So it's still, virtual conferences have much more benefits in terms of inclusiveness, reaching more people than physical conferences. But also another case for Africa, for example, there is a model that has been used by HFA Bionet. It's a bioinformatics network funded by NIH. They've been training people in basic bioinformatics skills for 3 years in a row. So what they do, they ask classes or universities or institutions to register, and then ask students to register in their respective institutions across Africa. So students meet at a university or in a research institute, and they watch either videos or they get contact with lecturers directly, virtually. So there are many ways to go around, so issues like networking, for example, by having hubs where people can meet locally and then they connect to other local hubs worldwide or in, say, one continent and continue sharing expertise and research as usual. So I would say still virtual conferences offer a lot more benefits than normal conferences.
So I was thinking while I was listening to every position which I share, but I was also thinking about the possibility of, you know, those radical scenario where you have to think like in a different way, which is like the kind of the scenario that we are experiencing right now. What would happen if we cannot have any more in-face conference, for instance? You know, you put that like a scenario and start thinking from that to today and what you can do about that. So we started the premise of our manuscript using the word improving, because that means that we think that a conference are good. So, but I was also thinking, what happened if we don't have any more conference? What are we getting out of? Because while we were writing this thing, it emerges some outrageous number about the $1 billion industry, which is conferences. And when I read that number, I was like, I was shocked. I was really shocked. As Pablo said, from Latin America, money is an issue. It's a very important issue. International conferences are completely elitist. It's like it has nothing to do with our minimum wage, our grants, our R&D spending. There is no real possibility that with our grants we can take our teams to those international meetings. In Argentina, you usually go to international conference only if you get invited to do a talk, and that would be if that's the case that you are one of the very few researchers who are recognized abroad and can get that invitation, etc. At least for the last 4 years, there was no scenario where you would spend $4,000 in a trip to Barbados to go to a conference instead of using those resources to do research, to generate results, because we were struggling to pay our electricity bills or our water system. So this is not even a question. So context is a lot here. It has a lot to do with what we are discussing, and that question emerges all the time when we are generating this manuscript. At least for me, that says, what are we getting in return for all those billion of dollars? Are we really? How can you measure that? Because if you cannot assess what you are getting out of those meetings, it's very difficult, you know, to try to improve them or try to generate. I'm very clear that what we propose will help make meetings the way they are more inclusive or more sustainable, etc. But I'm still in doubt of what we're getting out of all that money and all the resources you spend on that. I was thinking that today, we mentioned a lot of technologies that are replacing scholarly communications. I mean, I wouldn't be afraid of not having any more conference. I would be afraid of not having Twitter tomorrow, for instance, because all the new results I get from new research are just other researchers who are sharing their preprints of their new results there. So I will be more concerned if we don't have more meetings. But this is a very personal opinion. So I mean, I know there is a lot to improve. I know there are a lot of drawbacks that are continuing perpetuating the problems that conferences have had for the last 150 years. There are a lot of things that we can do to try to improve those. But I still think that's a question that we should have. I mean, I know that today it's very easy to say there is no way that next month you can join together 30,000 people in a place to do something. But what about in 2 years? Would that be a good idea? Would that be a good allocation of resources, or just that maybe I will speak a lot of other issues after?
I think that we can agree that we heavily promote virtual conferences, and that there are many benefits to it. So that's really our front line. I just wrote down four points, which one thing is that concerted efforts are very important. So this meeting by chance that was mentioned and meeting at random is not really serving women and underrepresented minorities. So this really has to go. The second point is that don't mourn the conference. That's our really key message. Mourn what was taken away from us for many years. All these opportunities for education and an interaction. So we are not really, we would like to decouple this from this COVID situation, which is people are mourning that conference, the useless, mostly conference. The third point is that this is in line with what everyone really beautifully discussed, which is what format it has to take. And I think you also mentioned in your piece, which is we have to decouple seminars from workshops, from networking events. And that's really important. So this will be a real change from this format of old legacy conferencing, which is all of this somehow had to happen together without much planning. And actually the preprint, the second version is now on BioArchive, and I have updated the figure in your piece. And there you can see that I went and analyzed networking separately from promotion events and from workshops, and then from the seminar aspect, which could be done virtually and then recorded. So that I think is important. And the last point, actually two very minor points. One is that I think Annette brought this up, the internet. And I think Umberto actually has contacted you with some data on internet accessibility in Africa and Latin America. And what's important to note, I think, is that you could have access to internet at home or at your institution. So if people can go to local hubs, which we also promote heavily, and Annette mentioned, and still be able to access the conference, it's a win. It's a huge win. And I think especially researchers, a lot of researchers, minorities don't have access to this, even to that. So it's important, I think, to distinguish home access from university. And in terms of bandwidth that Benjamin mentioned, you could lower the bandwidth, the quality. You could also have podcasts and audio versions. So it doesn't, not everyone has to be on video. So hubs are important. The bandwidth was also important. And finally, about childcare, we don't have childcare now because people that have to do childcare are closed. So that doesn't have anything to do with really what we were talking about in terms of legacy conferences. And that childcare at legacy conferences is very expensive. And that's why I have, we have this table at the end which talks about subsidizing childcare as well. So caregiver grants, on-site free, on-site at a cost, and no childcare, which is go take care of it with your hotel and so on. So I think from what everyone said was really, really great. And you can see why we have so many wonderful colleagues on this paper, but these three or four points, I think, are also mentioned in your piece, but also important to note. One other last thing I wanted to say was that we are hoping to nucleate this, as you know, as an initiative, because as human history shows, it is very likely that a lot of people are going to go back to the unfortunate format that used to be the case before. So there are a couple of groups that have contacted me. There is eLife community, and you also have introduced me to some. So we are hoping to maybe have a dedicated Slack channel or some other form. And I see that Pablo is also very active with ASCP. So I think that this has a really great future for practically implementing this in a lot of fields, not just molecular biology.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and it would be very lovely, I mean, for you to include us there as well, so, and keep in touch, because I think we'd be very interested in continuing that conversation. I mean, just as everyone was talking here, I hadn't quite managed to wrap my head around it until I was just listening to all of you right now. And it's this question. So there, I just realized that there's a huge personal historical bias about how we view the serendipity and meetings and all the things that we have experienced at conferences. And the thing is, for me, this forms a huge part of my scientific history and life, because I have been one of those privileged people. I have gone to the conferences and had someone walk past me and make a joke, and now we're still friends 10 years later. And so my brain has been shaped to believe that is the way to make those interactions happen. It doesn't have to be the only way.
Exactly. Right? And I can tell you that's the way I found how I started this thing that ended up with my new position that I'm already having, right? But I can tell you, we share something that other people don't.
Yes. No.
We are both men.
No.
To be what Sarvi said.
Yeah. No, absolutely. 100%. It's even worse than that, right? So men, but also I come from India, but I come from a long line of privileged institutions in my country that most people, a billion people, don't have access to. And, you know, so it adds up and it adds up and it adds up, right? So I'm very aware of this. But what I'm trying to follow on from that thought with is that in order to effect behavior change, all the well-meaning people who are in charge of organizing conferences, who have had careers this way, that have been shaped by these interactions, need to be taken to this reset without being told that their experiences are invalid. Because does that make sense? There's like a little bit of a dangerous space where there's lots of people who mean well, but haven't necessarily had a chance to experience how a different system might work. And maybe now is that time, because we're all being forced into it anyway.
Yeah. If I could just add on to that point, I agree completely. I think that conferences kind of even like select, or there's a certain level of selection bias. So, you know, it really kind of also selects for a certain group of people who are comfortable interacting in a face-to-face manner, or are comfortable with these kind of opportunities that they get by chance, which is really not available to many other people out there. And it also links back to Savi's point, right, that in many cases for underrepresented minorities, it's about making the concerted efforts to make these interactions. And I think, yeah, it's really true that it's going to be, a lot of it's going to be about convincing these people that these interactions can take place in a different way, that it does not have to be the historical way of conferences, that we can do networking in a different way. And I think that even networking in a different way would then actually, you know, start to advantage, or at least stop disadvantaging certain other people who may be disadvantaged because they're a minority, or maybe just because they're not good at, maybe they're introverts and not good at just randomly making a joke and walking down the street and meeting new people. So I think this is going to be a really big barrier in terms of convincing people on how to change conferences. But I agree completely that now this is the time when everybody now has to learn how to use Zoom and has to learn how to use Slack. And I think it's going to be a really great time to convince people that scientific interactions can take place in another way other than just face-to-face.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I want to say, for privileged people, two things will be happening that are going to be great for them. One is that they're going to save time, travel time. The second thing is that they're going to get the diversity of input from around the world. So diversity brings excellence to science. And if they have conferences, as we have portrayed in a new figure in the preprint, if you have a conference with 3,000 people from 60 countries, you can get a lot more ideas in as a privileged person or professor than you used to have in your small circle, not in in your small circle of people that you used to see in the traditional conferences. So I think if people agree to be less selfish and change their lifestyle of jet setting a little bit, they could really benefit a lot. And this is the privileged people that I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think what I'm really hearing here is that it's actually not about porting conferences online. I think it's because nobody wants to sit in front of Zoom for a whole day. Like nobody wants to do this. I think, and it doesn't work. I think it also doesn't work. Like, I know people who don't have these attention spans and which complain about they don't have this in person and they don't sit in a room and have a focus by sitting in a room and to listen to something and such. So I think it's really not that we suddenly have conferences which are 8 hours long every day, for 3 days in a row and looking into Zoom. I think it's really more about maybe reinventing how we do things more dramatically, as Humberto also said. Maybe it's just not valuable to have 3 days in a row if it's virtual. Maybe you split it up on multiple days or a month, or you do it completely differently. I think this is really where we have to go. It's not just, oh yeah, we do this what we did in person online, because nothing really works like that. I think none of the real good online interactions do work like that. They're not some of them are actually not real time. They're okay, somebody posts something on a Slack and I go 3 days later, reply to it. Similar, you watch a video of a talk and then you think about something and then you can be able to get in touch with the person in a different way. I mean, this is really what you have to explore in that space, in the long run, if you want to make this successful and not just a one-to-one copying over.
Yeah. And I think that also ties into things that are in the preprint and that other people have also talked about bringing in other modes of communication and dissemination, including preprints, into the process of a more asynchronous, longer-term format for having scientific interaction and conversation rather than this kind of clustered hub model. So I think that is absolutely true. Yeah. Do you have any other issues independent of the stuff we talked about that you'd want to share possibly with people reading the preprint? I mean, this is all obviously the beginning of a very long asynchronous conversation, so it doesn't have to all be clustered in here. I was just curious before we wrap up and let you get on with your days.
Maybe I say something before I shut up for the day. I kind of see this as an opportunity, open access was for publishing as such. I think it's an opportunity to really bring tons of really high, good quality content to masses who want to see it, and maybe also then in future experimented actually how to deliver this. And right now, actually, it's really hard to find really good stuff online. It's hard to find actually a good talk of anybody or a real expert talking about something. And I don't know why, really. If you get new students in the lab, most people actually learn via video content. That's how people learn stuff nowadays. But we don't, as a scientific community, we don't provide it to them. And I think also having these talks recorded, and then they're great teaching moments. So they're great, oh yeah, you want to learn about something? Go here. You learn from the world expert from XYZ. Oh yeah, do you want to see a different perspective? Go over there. Look at this. I mean, there could be a whole new world of science communication, how we actually communicate as a community there, which doesn't exist right now. I think it's a real opportunity here. Yeah.
I just want to say that with regards to what Benjamin mentioned about the format, it's true that people don't want to sit in one go at Zoom or some other webinar, but they can still have the conference go on for 2 weeks with a combination of recorded and live streaming. And I think we mentioned this in the paper, actually. And there are time zone differences anyways. So people have to be very accommodating. And I think they will still get a lot more out than in-person conferencing, where you get tired, you see 5 posters, and you're really done for the day. The second thing that he just mentioned, the new format, a lot can be happening with societies, improving communication, having a dedicated Slack in every field, let's say in hypertension, let's say that's a big research field, and improving interaction between ECRs and senior researchers. So this interaction doesn't necessarily have to happen in a week. It can be extended, and people can start collaborating later.
I just want to comment on that, about the Slack, because I thought of for the calcium signaling community, which I belong to. It's the European calcium signaling community, and we did the Slack, and it's really community-based. So these people are from different age to us, let's say, so they're not to say they are old, but most of them. And it's really hard to trigger them to use it. So it's been mostly used by the young guys from time to time. Of course, there is a hype moment and then it decreases. We have seen this in the eLife Ambassador program, where at the beginning there is a storm of things. Then you're overflow, and then many people feel like overwhelmed and they just drop it. And then you have after this hype, then it decreases and decreases and decreases. So something that will be really interesting and I will use will be kind of a guidelines from all the people that we hope will join this common effort that Sarv is talking about, that will can help us to kind of how to lead, how to guide a community, right? It's not so obvious to guide a community, to make a Slack with a common objective and give it a life. It's not an obvious thing. And I thought I would just launch the Slack and it will be like autopoietic. It will be alone generating, it will be babbling all day long. If there is people that belong to the society that are in Australia, so it will be 24/7. No way. It was not like that. So yeah, that would be another point that I would like to see. Now, she mentioned the common Slack for this initiative to know how to create a community, really, a virtual one. Because the live one, it already exists. People are friends, they communicate, they collaborate, but a virtual one, how to make this actually happen.
A very minor detail about what Benjamin was saying about format, and something that we have observed during the generation of this manuscript, is the very low public outreach events and which are typical in the status quo of conferencing. That's something which is strongly missing. It's like you join 1,000 people who are experts in one field, and they just go behind a closed room and talk it with each other, and they don't do anything for the community that they are hosting them or etc. So I think we have discussed this maybe with Sarvenas. I don't remember that. For instance, for in-person conference, we thought about the possibility of doing those, you know, like in public spaces, like in parks or whatever, where people can join, and you have to prepare also layperson briefings about what you are studying and reaching, and taking this to virtual meetings. That could be a possibility also, you know, to try to generate videos for a layperson audience about the importance of the research that you are doing. It's sometimes very difficult to get the attention of people beyond your speciality about what you do, you think is important to do. And so then we have I think we are obligated to try to be able to express that. So it's not only about the generation of results and science that you're doing, but also try to return the community which is hosting your in-person meeting with something like, we mentioned this in manuscript, but you know, something we do with, you know, cleaning events or anything. So I think that the public outreach aspect of meeting is really lagging behind all other things.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Absolutely. Just so that we don't, I'm just mindful of everybody's time. Did anybody want to raise anything else before we wrap up?
Yeah. So regarding the format of virtual conferences, which format they can take, I think when we are offering, we're not necessarily saying this is an easier option. We're just saying this is an alternative to physical conferences which have 1, 2, 3, 4 issues, right? And I think people, we should prepare people, we should expect, people should expect to experience a learning curve. It's a new way of doing things. Some people may not have the skills to actually host or attend virtual conferences. So there should be, as Sarvio has proposed recently, probably we should prepare a toolkit or resources for people who want to host or attend a virtual conference, and there should be a learning curve. But more importantly, it's also to experiment a bit on what works, what doesn't work, what new ways, how better can we host this conference without compromising the main goal of having them in the first place. So, but also we expect to have a bit of a resistance to people who are used to having physical meetings. It's easier to just stick to what is familiar, even if, well, an alternative is better, because learning something else takes resources and attention and all that. So we expect a bit of a resistance, especially for privileged people who, for them, the conferences worked just great. So we should also we also have that in mind as we keep pushing this forward. Yeah.
No, I was just also kind of curious. I mean, based on what Anna said about the learning curve, I mean, I'm also curious to know or to find out also what you found out, Gautam, about how conference organizers feel about, you know, what we've proposed in the preprint. I mean, personally, I've not organized any conferences, so I wouldn't know, you know, I'm sure we missed out many things about organizing conferences that maybe professional organizers have something to say about, or maybe they feel that, you know, some things would work better than others. I mean, I'm really curious to know what they said.
The two main things I'm hearing are, first of all, everybody is aware that things have to change. I mean, the degree to which they agree that they need to change, I think varies quite a lot, but I think everyone's aware that there's a need for a sea change. Everyone is obviously, the one people who had conferences to organize in the near future are 100% occupied by the logistics of how to shift it online. And then people who are thinking about the conferences that they would have attended in 2021 or beyond are starting to think about how to really do them differently. So definitely organizers are in the right mind space to be part of a discussion about how to take this forward. But I think two things are really critical. One, as Sarvana said already, you have to bring people into a common forum. So first of all, just so that they can receive input, but also so that they don't feel that they're doing this in isolation, you know, independently of everyone else. And also that they don't feel that they're just being attacked in some kind of unspecific way, because everybody's worked very hard to put their meetings together. It's voluntary time for most of them. It's, you know, it's like a labor of love for some of these people. So I think that community needs to happen. And the second thing that needs to happen that I think some people are starting to do is to document very carefully experiences in the first wave of fully online or semi-virtual conferences, right? So the big Genetic Society meeting is starting tomorrow. There's multiple other ones that the preprint cited that have already happened, and then there will be more. And some of the biggest meetings that haven't even said yet that they will do it this way will probably have to shift. So I think if we can help to make the community happen, and if we can help to document everybody's experiences, then this will. The learning curve that Anna talked about, that will happen. It will happen very quickly, actually, and people will switch over quicker than expected. But just to end, those responses that I got, I will put them all on a. They're a bit too long to include in the main piece, so I'll just link to a separate document maybe, and of course I'll share that with all of you, and it'll be linked to from the piece. And I'm envisioning that it could somehow eventually become part of a bigger body of evidence that people provide on their experiences, and I'd be happy to contribute in whatever way.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to hear those the feedback, and I kind of expected some of that. I think it was great to hear a sea change, really. I mean, if I see people tweeting about this manuscript, and I see some deep impressions, and that's already a huge milestone, I think, for something coming out of a community, especially a young community. The second thing is, you mentioned documenting experiences is really important. Surveying or actually actively interviewing participants, all of them, I think is really important. Disclosing statistics is very important. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. And I only have two references of two conferences that actually explicitly showed gender breakdown and a statement of gender equity. And it's a huge, it's offensive to women that attend these, really, to not see that. The third thing is that thinking inclusively is very important. So I don't really buy that putting an event together is my child, or I have spent this time on it, or it's dear to my heart, you know. If it has these issues, it hasn't been inclusive. So it really needs reform. And as someone who has only attended three or four conferences in her entire career, for all these reasons, I can say that having a continuous dialogue is really important. And we aren't expecting a sudden change, you know, but I think with continuous dialogue, we can have more senior people that are really used to old ways to change in the future. I don't think we expect a change in 6 months, but maybe in 2 years, 2 to 3 years, we could have a large number of conferences that are semi or fully virtual.
Okay, so we're almost at 2 o'clock. I think we'll end here. It's been really lovely to chat with you. I'm very glad to meet all of you virtually, and hopefully we can keep in touch. So just to clarify that anything that I put down there in the preprint in the pre-light is my personal opinion, and if I link to anything from you guys or from other people who've responded, it will be clearly specified that that's the case. And so, I mean, I'm also in, we want this discussion format also to be as lively as possible. So even if we continue to have, let's say you want to supplement it or some agreements or some additional thoughts, like we can always add them as comments later, to the final piece and, you know, and continue from there. So just to make clear that that's the case. So I'm very grateful for your time. And I hope you all have a good rest of the week.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
guys. It was good fun.
Thanks, everyone.
Yes. Yeah.